All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 651 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for step two and step three. Okay, so today we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for step two and step three. Again, a lot of very important things to be discussed today. All right, so let's jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about, and I'm going to be making quite a number of kind of strange integrations today, so I'd keep this in mind, right? So I want to focus on a lot of, you'll see what I mean as I go. So what if they give you a question about an old guy, right? And he has like very severe abdominal pain, right? He's a smoker, and they tell you that you feel a pulsatile lower abdominal mass, right? What should you be thinking about? Well, I really hope you're saying that, oh, Divine, this sounds a lot like a ruptured AAA, right? This sounds an awful lot like a ruptured AAA, right? So this person has a ruptured abdominal aortic aneurysm, right? And remember, AAAs, typically they're going to arise below the renal arteries, right? I think that's one of those kind of high yield things you want to make sure you know for your exams, right? They typically arise below the renal arteries. And again, what's the biggest risk factor for an abdominal aortic aneurysm? Well, the biggest risk factor is going to be smoking, right? Smoking is the biggest risk factor for abdominal aortic aneurysm, right? And one thing you'll notice on the USMLE exams, and this is something you should certainly look up, is that sometimes when a person has a AAA that is ruptured or about to rupture, they may show you something called the draped aorta sign on imaging, right? The draped aorta sign on imaging, right? So what does that mean? Well, the thing is, typically when a person has the draped aorta sign, it's something you see typically on a CT scan, right? But you'll notice that that the posterior wall of the aorta, right? The posterior wall of the aorta, like the margins are very indistinct, right? It's almost like the aorta, the posterior aorta, is draping over the walls of the vertebra. Because remember, the vertebra come behind, or they're very closely associated with the aorta, right? So that's something I certainly know for exams if I were you, right? So the draped aorta sign is one of these things, is old timer, old school, but it's pretty high yield to know for your exams, right? And remember, people that have a ruptured AAA, they're going to be hemodynamically unstable, they're going to have flank pain, they're going to have back pain, right? Because again, remember, the AAA, the abdominal aorta is retroperitoneal, right? Now, the thing is, sometimes our friends at the MBMEs, again, especially they know that these days we live in an Anki and an AI generation, right? So one thing they love to do is, instead of just asking about a classic association, they will ask you about the underlying mechanism or the underlying pathophysiology. Do not be afraid to pick an answer that talks about elastin and collagen degradation on your test. You're like, wait, what? Yes, I mean exactly what I just said, right? Elastin and collagen degradation in the media, right? From increased matrix metalloproteinase activity, right? I'm going to say that again. So the thing is, when people have a ruptured AAA, or when people have an abdominal aortic aneurysm, right? The mechanism there is they have increased matrix metalloproteinase activity. When you have an increase in the activity of matrix metalloproteinase, that is going to lead to the degradation of elastin and collagen in the media of your abdominal aorta, and that can cause problems, right? And the thing is, it is actually kind of high yield to know that statins decrease the activity of matrix metalloproteinases. But smoking increases the activity of matrix metalloproteinases, right? Proteinase, again, something that breaks down proteins, right? Think about it. If a person has COPD, right, there's all these proteases in the lungs that have increased activity with smoking, right? So I want you to kind of link those activities together. Proteinase, protease, right? They're kind of similar. Proteinase breaks down proteins, right? It's kind of the same idea. All right, so this is part of the reason why when people have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, we tend to put them on statins, on high-intensity statins. Why? Because, again, we want to decrease matrix metalloproteinase activity in those vessels, right, so that they don't, have like a plaque rupture or whatever, right? Again, guys, please, today's podcast has a lot of strange things, but they are very high-yield things to know for your exams, right? And again, again, sometimes on the exams concerning the AAA, they can ask you, like, what's the mechanism behind these people having back pain? Well, again, typically, if it ruptures, it's going to rupture into the left retroperitoneum, right? It's going to rupture. I'm not saying always, right? But it can typically rupture into the left peritoneum, right? So they can have back pain, just kind of like you have with acute pancreatitis, which is also, you know, your pancreas, especially certain parts are retroperitoneal, right? And again, what is the most common location of the rupture and whatnot? It's typically going to be below the renal arteries, right? And it's going to be above the aortic bifurcation, right? Again, the USMLEs these days has become an exam of surrogates, right? Has become an exam of surrogates. They won't typically test you on something direct. They will ask you about something that surrounds the concept, a surrounding concept, right? So it can be a AAA question, right? It can be painfully obvious that, oh yeah, of course, this is a AAA question. But then they ask something that you're not expecting, right? So the most common location is going to be below the renal arteries and above the aortic bifurcation, right? And again, remember, when people have aortic aneurysms, right, typically, we're going to monitor, we monitor these people like every year or thereabouts, right? And we're going to intervene if the aneurysm grows by more than half a centimeter in 6 months or a centimeter in a year, right? We're going to fix it. Another situation where we would also fix the AAA is if it's more than 5.5 centimeters on initial screening, right? Or you have symptoms, right? You're like very symptomatic, you're having severe symptoms. We're going to go ahead and fix it, right? Or if imaging shows something very concerning, like this drip aorta sign, you know, even if it has not ruptured, we're still going to fix it as well, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient just came in for a AAA repair, right? And then they ask, they tell you that, oh, the patient passes away, you know, like 24 hours after repair. And then they ask you, what is the most likely cause of mortality around the repair of this person's AAA? I would really hope that you're going to pick the answer that talks about a myocardial infarction. I would really, really hope that you pick the answer that talks about a myocardial infarction. The USMLEs, they like to ask these questions that talk about the most likely cause of mortality, the most likely prognosis, right? These are things that I address in many of my podcasts and also address pretty heavily in my classes, right? But the most likely cause of mortality around a AAA repair, right? A person that is had their AAA repaired, right, is a myocardial infarction, right? And the thing is, sometimes on your exams, they can ask that, oh, which of the following provides the best outcomes between endovascular aneurysm repair and open repair? The thing is that they likely have similar, it's not likely, they largely have similar survival outcomes, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient, and this patient has had his abdominal aortic aneurysm repaired, right? And then they tell you that, oh, prior to the patient departing from the hospital, they do a CT angiogram of the abdomen, right? And they notice fluid extravasating into the excluded aneurysm. They notice fluid extravasating into the excluded aneurysm. On your exams, you want to think of the answer that talks about an endoleak. An endoleak is actually more common with an endovascular aneurysm repair than with an open repair, right? But make sure you know that concept of an endoleak, right? So that endovascular procedure you did, things are still leaking a little bit into the excluded aneurysm. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has had, I'm trying to make this rapid review like a thematic review. And by the way, this is rapid review series 136. I want to kind of make it a thematic in a sense, right? So what if they give you a question and they tell you that, oh, this person, you know, has had his abdominal aneurysm, you know, the patient was admitted to the hospital 24 hours ago, has had the aneurysm repaired. And then this patient has bloody diarrhea, has very severe abdominal pain, has leukocytosis, right? When you see something like this, I want you to consider ischemic colitis. Again, the thing is, repairs of AAAs are not necessarily low-risk surgery, right? They're certainly not low-risk surgery, right? So one thing that can happen is that you can have ischemia to parts of the, to branches of the aorta, right? And that can cause problems, right? Like this person having ischemic colitis. Many times you can try conservative treatment for this, but if there are signs of necrosis, you need to go ahead and resect. Or they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that the patient is like completely paralyzed in the bilateral lower extremities after a AAA repair. Then the thing you certainly want to think about is a person having a anterior cord syndrome, right, where they've pretty much infarcted the artery of Adamkiewicz, right, which supplies the anterior two thirds of the spinal cord. You'll notice that those people, they're completely paralyzed, you know, they're completely paralyzed. The only thing that will be intact spinal cord wise will be fine touch vibration and proprioceptive sense, right? Because remember, the dorsal columns are in the posterior third of the spinal cord, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, had a triple A repair 2 years ago and just returns for a follow-up exam, and this patient has a hemoglobin of 7.5, and you're told that you know, test of his stool for blood is positive, right? That he has hemocult positive stool. If you see something like this, you really, really want to think about a person having something called an aortoenteric fistula, right? So basically, these people have formed a fistula from the aorta, right? From the aneurysm that was excluded to their GI tract. So they're literally bleeding into their GI tracts, right? These people are going to need vascular imaging of the GI tract pretty quickly, like a CT angiogram or something like that. And you need to fix that problem. If not, one day they're gonna have a catastrophic bleed, and then they're almost certainly gonna die. All right, now what if they give you a question about a patient, right, that presents with a ruptured triple A, right, what looks like a ruptured triple A, and they're hemodynamically stable on initial presentation? What kind of diagnostic testing do you want to do? Well, again, I'm hoping you're picking the answer that talks about a CT angiogram. But if they're unstable, right, and they have direct physical exam findings, you know, like they have a pulsatile mass, for example, pick the answer that just takes them straight to the operating room. Okay. Pick the answer that takes them straight to the operating room. But if they're unstable and they have no direct physical exam findings, get an abdominal ultrasound going. All right. So let's talk through these treatment decisions, right? Or these diagnostic workup decisions. If a person has a ruptured triple A and on initial presentation, they're hemodynamically stable, pick a CT angiogram. Right? If they're unstable and they have direct physical exam findings, right, like a pulsatile mass, take them to the operating room. But if they're unstable and they have no direct physical exam findings of a ruptured triple A, go ahead and do an abdominal ultrasound, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has very severe epigastric pain, right? And they tell you that this person has a history of osteoarthritis and the person has been on chronic pharmacotherapy. Well, I'd really, really hope that you're thinking about a person having like some kind of GI ulcer, right? Like a gastric ulcer or a duodenal ulcer, right? Now, the thing is, I try to be kind here with my initial presentation. Oh, person has a history of osteoarthritis and young chronic pharmacotherapy, right? They know that all of you have memorized that. Let's do a more difficult vignette. What if they give you a question about a patient, right? And by the way, this person that I just gave the easy vignette for, right, has a NSAID-induced peptic ulcer disease, right? But what if they give you a question about a patient and this person has a history of like severe asthma and the person has been on chronic pharmacotherapy, right? And then the person presents with acute onset, very severe epigastric pain. Then I'd really hope you're saying that, ooh, divine, this person has a steroid-induced ulcer. Whoa, yeah, right? You know, I tell people this in many of my classes, right? Many people always flip out about USMLE pool changes, right? Let me tell you this. The USMLEs, when they do a pool change, right, it's not like they just manufacture like tons and tons and tons of new topics that nobody has ever seen before, right? Don't get me wrong. Medicine is an ever-expanding science, but it does not expand so much that they can generate completely new topics every single time. No, that would be ridiculous because they still need to test the basics that people need to understand. But what do they do? What's a pool change? A pool change is the same concept tested differently in many cases. The same concept tested differently in many cases, right? So just keep that in mind as you prepare for your exams, right? So this person, you know, because they know that many of you have memorized this in probably every Anki deck known to mankind, right? Or you've probably seen a bunch of Q-Bank questions on this. You know, a person chronically taking NSAIDs for whatever reason, and then they have like sudden onset severe epigastric pain, they probably have like a ruptured ulcer, right? A perforated ulcer, right? But, you know, what are other things that cause ulcers and the person can have acute onset severe epigastric pain? It can be a person that chronically takes steroids, right? Or the person can even have just chronic epigastric pain, right? That steroids have caused the ulcers, right? This is why if people are going to be on steroids for a long period of time, we tend to put them on PPIs, right? Or you see a person having like very severe epigastric pain after they've been in the hospital for a variceal bleed that was treated. Again, they have an ulcer, right? Remember, if you have a lot of blood loss, that can cause ischemia to your GI mucosa, and that can cause ulceration of your GI mucosa, right? Or they can give you the exact same question in a person that has suffered a severe burn, right? And the person has had a stable course in the hospital, and then they suddenly start complaining of severe epigastric pain, right? You see free air under the diaphragm, right? They have an ulcer that has ruptured, right? That's like a curling ulcer, right? So remember, we can see these things in people with burns, people with ischemia, people with increased intracranial pressures and things like that. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a person, right, that, you know, has a history of high blood pressure, right? Again, this is going to be an easy vignette coming through here, right? Tearing chest pain, radiating to the back. I know some of you are like, yeah, divine, aortic dissection. Yes, it's aortic dissection, right? Remember, typically on imaging, you're going to see a widened mediastinum, right? And again, sometimes on your exams, instead of putting aortic dissection as an answer, they'll put vascular intimal tear as an answer. Again, they'll put a surrogate for what they know that you know, right? It's a vascular intimal tear that dissects through into the media, right? Creates that false lumen. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that is a 45-year-old female and a BMI is 42, right? And she has like very significant upper abdominal pain, right? On your exams, significant upper abdominal and back pain. If you see this on your exams, what should you be thinking about? I'd really hope you're saying that, divine, this sounds an awful lot like acute pancreatitis, right? So again, remember, it's not always people that are alcoholic that will get acute pancreatitis. People that are also obese can get acute pancreatitis. People on GLP-1 agonists can also get acute pancreatitis. People on valproic acid can also get acute pancreatitis. People on stavudine and didanosine can also get acute pancreatitis. There are many of the HIV drugs that cause acute pancreatitis, right? So keep that in mind on your exams, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they show you an EKG and they tell you that this patient for the last 3-4 hours has been having very severe upper abdominal pain, right? Severe upper abdominal pain, or they can see severe left upper quadrant pain, right? When you see something like this and they show you an EKG and you notice that, wow, the QRS complexes are all narrow, but the spaces between the QRS complexes are diminished, right? Or they show you a sawtooth pattern on an EKG. When you see something like this, I want you to think of acute mesenteric ischemia, right? So the thing is, that first EKG I described is a person that has AFib, right? The second EKG I described is a person that has atrial flutter, right? Believe it or not, it's not only people that have AFib that can get this problem that this person has of acute mesenteric ischemia, right? If you have any other arrhythmia that causes an uncoordinated contraction of the heart, right? So say, for example, a person has AFib or a person has atrial flutter, the person can have acute mesenteric ischemia that way. And also, don't forget, if you've had a recent MI, cardiac muscle has died, so your cardiac muscles are not contracting in unison. They're not contracting in a coordinated fashion. That can also cause acute mesenteric ischemia, right? And this person that has the left upper quadrant hurting probably has an occlusion of the superior mesenteric artery. That's probably one of the more common arteries that are occluded in acute mesenteric ischemia on the USMLE exams. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has, you have this 68-year-old male, and they tell you that he has a history of like blood in his stool, right? And then for the last 2 days, he has been having very severe pain on the left side of his abdomen, right? And they, you know, give you a temperature, you know, left side of his abdomen, you know, they'll be intentionally vague. If they want to be nice, they'll give you left lower quadrant pain. But sometimes they can be intentionally vague and say, you know, left side of the abdomen, right? And this patient has a fever. If you see something like that, you really want to think about diverticulitis, right? So this person has a history of painless, bloody bowel movements, right? That's going to be diverticulosis, right? And now this person has fever, this person has left lower quadrant pain. Think of diverticulitis, right? And remember, when a person has diverticulitis, you want to diagnose it with a CT scan and do not do a colonoscopy, right? So you don't rupture the person's bowel. You don't rupture the person's bowel. Keep that at the back of your mind as you prep for your exams, right? And then let's just run through a few risk factors real quick, right? So what's the biggest risk factor for a AAA? You know, at least let's kind of talk about some of these topics we've talked about, right? Remember, it's going to be smoking, right? What's the biggest risk factor for aortic dissection? Remember, it's going to be high blood pressure, hypertension. What is the biggest risk factor for a stroke? Or remember, it's going to be high blood pressure, right? And then what's the biggest risk factor for coronary artery disease? It's going to be smoking. It's going to be smoking, right? It's going to be smoking. You know, there's one confusion that many people kind of pop up with these days on the exams. And I see this all the time on Reddit. I'm like, what are these people doing, right? See, guys, the fact that something is a modifiable risk factor does not make it the biggest risk factor for a problem. It just means that, oh, you can modify it, basically, like, oh, you can maybe stop doing that thing and you won't get that bad outcome. But the fact that something is a modifiable risk factor does not necessarily make it the biggest risk factor for a problem. Just keep that in mind, right? And then another basic we want to know about AAA, since we've said so much about AAAs today, right? Remember, the screening guideline, right? If you have any smoking history, right, and you're between the ages of 65 to 75 and you're a male, we're going to screen you with an ultrasound, right? And also, if you're a first degree relative, you should also screen first degree relatives, right? So if you have a first degree relative that has like a AAA or history of a AAA, you should get screened for a AAA if you're a man, right? If you're a man. So keep that in mind on your exams, right? And what's the normal diameter of the aorta below the renal arteries? It's typically 2, right? But once it becomes more than 1, you know, if it becomes 1.5 times or more, that amount, right? So like 3 centimeters or more, then that tells us that, okay, you have an abdominal aortic aneurysm, right? So remember, again, if it grows by more than half a centimeter in 6 months or a centimeter in a year, it's like, ooh, we're going to fix it, right? If it's more than 5.5 centimeters on initial presentation, ooh, we're going to fix it. If you're symptomatic, ooh, we're going to fix it, right? So keep that in mind for your exams, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has sudden onset severe leg pain, right? And they have like no pulses in the legs. They have like just very severe pain, a lot of paresthesias, a lot of pallor, right? They have like pallor. They tell you that they have like unilateral lower extremity pallor. Then you want to think about acute limb ischemia. Today, I'm trying to introduce concepts with simple. I want to kind of get you thinking like the MBMEs. I want to introduce the concept with a simple vignette and then start going into the more difficult directions that they love to exploit, right? So you're like, okay, Divine, yeah, pain in the low extremities, sudden onset, no pulses, paresthesias, pallor of the extremities. Of course, Divine, that's acute limb ischemia. All right, good, right? And the easy peasy one is you're going to find it in people that have a history of a recent MI or people that have a history of AFib, right? Think of acute limb ischemia. No big deal, right? No harm, no foul. Okay. Now, let's go in some strange directions that you may see on your exams, right? So, first thing is, obviously, right, these people formed an embolus in their heart, right? The person probably has like AFib or recent MI, formed an embolus in the heart, and then it flicked off wind and occluded a low extremity vessel, right? Now, sometimes on the USMLE exams, they'll want to kind of trick you with between this and compartment syndrome, right? So be careful, right? The thing is, people that have compartment syndrome, typically, they're going to have pain with just any kind of movement of the extremity, right? Pain with literally any kind of passive motion of the extremity, that's compartment syndrome. That's not going to be acute limb ischemia, right? So just keep that at the back of your mind for your exams. And typically, compartment syndrome tends to be associated with trauma, as against acute limb ischemia, that tends to be associated more with, you know, like recent MI or AFib and things like that, right? And then if they give you a question, again, let's do some simple things and then let's start hitting some strange things, right? So if they give you a question about a person that, you know, is a big time smoker, right? And the person has pain with walking that improves with rest, right? Think of peripheral arterial disease, right? Sometimes on your exams, instead of using the term peripheral arterial disease, they'll use the alternate name, chronic limb ischemia. Okay, so there's acute limb ischemia, and then there's chronic limb ischemia. Chronic limb ischemia is literally another name for peripheral arterial disease. Again, remember, the USMLEs, they may use alternate names on your exams, right? And then remember, if a person has chronic limb ischemia and you notice that they started having paralysis, that may be an indication that those people need probably they need amputation or they need immediate vascular intervention, right? And then remember, the most common cause of arterial emboli is going to be AFib. The most common cause of arterial emboli is going to be AFib, right? Okay, now, what if they try to give you an anatomy question with a person that has acute limb ischemia, right? And they tell you that, you know, the person has like unilateral foot and calf pain, right? And the person has barely palpable or very indistinct femoral pulses and no pulses in the, no, you know, pedal pulses are absent and whatnot. Where's the problem? Where's the occlusion? Well, the occlusion is going to be at the common femoral artery or the superficial femoral artery, right? But if they give you a question about a person that has like unilateral foot pain and they have intact femoral pulses, but they have absent pedal pulses, they want to think about this person having occlusion of the popliteal artery, right? Now, our friends at the MBMEs, they can literally give you an acute limb ischemia question and ask you, like, what's the most likely mechanism behind this patient's presentation? And they'll put an answer that talks about embolic phenomena. They'll put an answer that talks about thrombotic phenomena. They'll put an answer that talks about vascular interruption or something like that. What answer should you pick? Let me let you think about that for a second. What answer should you pick? Well, please pick the answer that talks about thrombotic phenomena. Whoa! Divine, I've always thought that acute limb ischemia was secondary to embolic phenomena. No, it's not. No, it's not. The most common cause, actually, believe it or not, is thrombotic phenomena, right? So you have an atherosclerotic plaque in a vessel, especially in people that have a history of peripheral arterial disease. It ruptures, right, and then goes and occludes a distal vessel or whatever, right? Kind of like an MI. It's almost like an MI of your lower extremities, like in a lower extremity artery, right? So remember, the most common cause of acute limb ischemia is a thrombotic phenomenon, kind of like an MI. Not necessarily embolic. I know many resources, even I have, you know, talk about AFib, recent MI, aflutter, form an embolus in the heart, flakes off, goes, occludes, a lower extremity artery. Yes, 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 yes. But the most common cause is thrombotic, right? The USMLEs, they love to throw out these epidemiologic questions. They love to throw out these epidemiologic questions, right? You can see that if you've not heard this from this podcast, I can almost promise you, you probably get this stuff wrong on an exam, right? And again, remember, how do we treat acute limb ischemia, right? Pretty straightforward, right? Go ahead and give them heparin, right? Give them some kind of anticoagulation, right? Heparin, right? And then do a CT angiogram of the lower extremities, right? And again, if you notice that they have like an irregular rhythm on auscultation, you should probably go ahead and get a TTE, a transthoracic echocardiogram, to maybe screen them for like some kind of clot in the left atrial appendage, right? And typically, we're going to manage it with embolectomy, right? Or you can do a catheter-directed thrombolysis, right? Although that tends to be more for mild cases. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, they had acute limb ischemia, they were successfully revascularized, and then they give you an EKG, and you notice that, this person has like a YQRS, and their creatinine has started rising. It's like, gee, what's going on here? If you see something like this, I want you to think of a reperfusion injury, right? Reperfusion injury, right? So remember, after you fix a part of a limb that has been ischemic, sometimes that reperfusion, you know, the influx of blood and oxygen back, sometimes can cause like some free radical damage, and you start having muscle cells exploding, right? You'll notice that these people's creatine kinase is elevated, right? And they can have like, because muscle cells are exploding because of the free radical injury, they may have myoglobinuria. That's what's causing the creatinine to rise, right? And as those muscle cells are exploding, remember, potassium is an intracellular ion, right? So those people can have hyperkalemia. Those people can have what? Hyperkalemia. Those people can have what? Hyperkalemia, right? Obviously, right? Like if they're having these EKG findings, you want to go ahead and give them calcium gluconate. Calcium gluconate. All right. So stabilize that myocardium. All right. So thank you for listening to me today. I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I think I've made enough of vascular integrations, right? So please, this podcast is just one of those rapid reviews that kind of sits there on its own. But there is so much high-yield stuff I talked about today, right? And if you love the way I teach, you're going to love my classes. You know, literally starting next week, Tuesday, I have a 25-hour step one reviews for step one, and for those taking step two, step three, to have a poor or a distant basic science foundation, right? I'm telling you that class is going to be really, really helpful to your studying. It's going to be really helpful to your studying because, again, the USMLEs these days on step two, step three, they have started testing basic sciences more and more, right? In fact, these days, I think I strongly recommend more and more people take that step one class. And then, you know, after that, so it's a 25-hour class. And then after that, I have a step three CCS framework class, right? So if you're taking step three, I want to think of it as like the pathophysiology of CCS cases, right? I have that class on the 18th. And then I have a test taking strategies class, that's for step one to three, biostats class for step one to three, social sciences, quality improvement, ethics, and a hospital medicine review also for step one to step three, right? And then after that, I have a last minute review just for step two and step three, and a 20-hour step two, step three review, right? And then in the month of June next month, I have a very, very clutch 50-hour step two, step three review, right? We go through tons of questions. That class is just exceptional, right? Very, very, very limited spots still available. So if you're interested, shoot me an email and I can give you some more information. And remember, I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams. And I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. And I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcast and Videos, where I have some really good videos on there and some podcasts as well. And then also, you know, many of you know I'm a Christ follower. I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com, DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post one or you know, at least a podcast where, from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. There's 391 episodes on there, right? There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. Share this with your friends and your colleagues, please. This podcast is really high yield. There's a reason why you see me emphasize certain things I emphasize in this podcast. But I'll see you in episode 652. Have a wonderful day. God bless you, and bye for now. Thank you.